welcome everyone back to New Books in Education on the New Books Network. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and I'm very excited today for a book that I'm quite personally interested in, and hopefully all of you are as well. This is Confucius and the Crisis in American Universities, Culture, Capital, and Diplomacy in U.S. Public Higher Education. And this is from Amy Stombach, and it's published out of Routledge, and it's 2014, so fairly recent book. And this is from a series, Education in Global Context. And Amy does a really nice job of looking at the Confucius Institutes in higher education within the United States. And she looks at several universities and studied them quite closely, and it was there, and kind of embedded herself. And so she has a great understanding of these institutions, which, you know, every 6 months to a year seem to pop up on the news or something, and we see some sort of controversy or story on these institutions. So this is definitely a great book to really understand the inside of the workings of these institutions within the higher education context of the American system. So without further ado, Amy, thank you. Welcome for coming on. And if we can just begin, can you tell me a little bit about how you sort of got here intellectually, and maybe just, you know, how you got into China, Confucius Institutes, and higher education as well? Thank you.
Sure. Well, first of all, Ryan, thank you very much for having me on this show. The series you're doing is really an asset for education studies, so I'm really thrilled to be here. You introduced the book by suggesting that I'm a scholar of China studies, and I want to begin by saying I am new to the area of China studies, and I don't consider myself a China expert. Anything that I've learned in the way of China, I have gained largely from this project and working with colleagues and scholars who are affiliated with Confucius Institutes in the U.S. So I want to acknowledge that and them for sharing their knowledge. I am by training an anthropologist, so some couple of decades ago I began conducting field research in probably what was the quintessential field sites at that time, parts of Africa. Mm. And at a time when my colleagues, my peers in the 80s and early 90s, way back then, were interested in anthropology, ritual and kinship, medicine, medical anthropology, I was really interested in the start in the area of education. And how education, broadly understood, broadly seen to include child rearing, socialization, and schools, how education serves as a site for the cultivation of communities and of knowledge. And so I began to work from an anthropological perspective on the subject of education for my early work. From my area background in African studies, I moved all the way, if you will, from that to looking at higher education in the U.S. Mm-hmm. This particular book is what I consider to be an ethnographic study of higher education institutions in the U.S., written from an anthropological perspective and drawing on some of what I feel are anthropological contributions to the way we might see higher education around the world, but in this case, particularly in the U.S. So as an Africanist anthropologist, I found myself, oddly, in the position of writing this book on higher education in the United States. I became interested in this topic specifically through some wonderful administrative work that I was doing in my former university, the University of Wisconsin, with which I continue to maintain an affiliation. I had been a director of global studies and was quite aware of where China fit in on the landscape of U.S. higher education. People are keen, parents are keen to have their children learn Chinese, where it was Japanese 10 years ago, perhaps China seems to be on everyone's radar screen right now. So I became very interested in sort of how in the higher education arena, China figured into a U.S. cultural imaginary, if you will. So here's an Africanist anthropologist looking at culture in America, trying to understand how China figures into a U.S. higher education landscape.
Okay, fantastic. And so you mentioned your sort of Midwest roots in Wisconsin. Can you Can you maybe mention, I guess, two things? Maybe explain to our audience what a Confucius Institute is, or what kind of organization that is, and then explain the universities which you sort of embedded yourself with as you were making this study. If you could introduce those universities.
Sure. Confucius Institutes are a very interesting language and cultural school that's sponsored by the Ministry of Education, and it's one of its assets or institutions, the Hanban. The Hanban and Ministry of Education have reached out, if you will, to countries around the world beginning in 2005, offering, to put it in the Hanban language, offering the opportunity for universities to draw on resources from the government of China to teach Chinese language and culture within universities around the world. So in 2014, there are more than 300 Confucius Institutes funded by the government of China operating in universities around the world, not only in the United States, but in many, many countries. Confucius Institutes are unique in that they are located typically, and I'll just speak of the typical case, they're located typically within universities themselves. They are not separate language schools offered through embassies or cultural attaché offices, as are the British Council or the French language schools. Rather, Confucius Institutes are unique in that they are set up within universities themselves. The controversy surrounding that, you would use the word embedded in a way, the controversy surrounding the embeddedness of Confucius Institutes within universities is they begin to challenge to some and open opportunities to others for new kinds of thinking about what a border is between universities and the nation state, basically. And so some of the issues that I bring up in the book are about ways in which Confucius Institutes are both seen as opportunities and debates. So Confucius Institutes are language schools or language courses that are offered within universities around the world. These institutes are funded through the government of China. They are created through a contract with the host university. So in the United States, for instance, a host university will contract with a partner university in China and with the government of China, Hanban, or Ministry of Education. So each university has a partnership with a Chinese university, and the courses that Confucius Institutes offer are typically not for credit courses. That's not always the case, and we're seeing some more discussion about for credit classes, but the way Confucius Institutes began in 2005, and until recently in the main, they were not-for-credit classes offered within universities, teaching Chinese language at various levels, teaching arts and culture, to some extent history, some of the controversy surrounding the Confucius Institutes in various universities has to do with what and how they are teaching. So I hope that addresses the question. What are Confucius Institutes?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think you kind of touched on it exactly, sort of that controversial bit, because it is funded from the Chinese government and sort of thinking of academic integrity and freedom and things like that. So if you could maybe introduce the schools that the universities that you were sort of with during the study.
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. If I could just first say a bit more about Confucius Institutes and the way they've been studied, and then how this work tries to approach it in a different way.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the highlights of the book, sort of the different direction that it has taken in some of its analysis.
Okay, yeah, I hope it does. I hope it's a complimentary and adds something to the conversation. Much of the discussion and writing about Confucius Institute has been about Confucius Institutes as a form of Chinese soft power, analogous to the kind of soft power we might see in the Fulbright program from the U.S. or British Council English language programs. And that certainly is an argument that I'm not disputing in this work. But what I'm interested in doing in this very short ethnography, which I hope is written for a general audience and therefore is accessible, what I hope to do in this work is to show that it's a two-way street. There's a reason that institutions take up Confucius Institutes. There's I draw on my former teacher, Marshall Sullins, this structure of conjuncture. There is a two-sided direction to the road, and it meets at a particular point. And what I try to do in this work is discuss what that intersection is and why U.S. Universities are taking up the Confucius Institutes. The reasons have to do with cuts in higher education and arguments that universities and administration in particular make to their stakeholders about the need for new funding. And China, the government of China, offers some degree of new funding for foreign language, Chinese language, that has been cut. I argue in this work that that's not the only nor even the sole reason that universities in the U.S. that I'm studying take up Confucius Institutes. There are also diplomatic reasons for working with colleagues and universities around the world. And for better or for worse, I coined the phrase, I think it's a coin of a phrase, edu-plomacy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Universities, and others have written about this too, universities are diplomatic sites not only for the education of the next generation and skills training, but there's a lot of diplomacy and connection among countries that goes on through the research and teaching missions of the university. And so I talk about the ways in which U.S. These institutions come at Confucius Institutes with a logic of their own, not putting aside arguments about soft power. I'm not discounting them, but there's more than that, I'm arguing. So I find that the soft power argument is not sufficient for understanding the full uptake that we see of Confucius Institutes in these universities. Now, you asked me to introduce the universities themselves. This is an ethnography, and so what I try to do, in addition to showing that conjuncture of interests, I try also to give a human face to the Confucius Institutes, not only of teachers, but also of the students, U.S. students in the main, who come to the institutions. The institutions that I feature in this work are a particular kind. They are public U.S. higher education institutions. They're public institutions, not the private so-called elite institutions of the U.S. And the public institution here is key because they have been subject to cuts in funding, congressional cuts in funding, beginning about 2012, cuts for foreign languages and international training for our students in the world, as you will, if you will. So the public universities have been subject to these cuts and have been affected more greatly than the privates by the decline in funding. And so the argument, at any rate, is stronger in the public higher education institutions that Confucius Institutes will provide a new funding stream. Again, that's not a sufficient argument, but that is one argument that the publics are making. It's a whole different game at play that I haven't studied in the private institutions with regard to Confucius Institutes. So another point that I should make is the settings of these Confucius Institutes that I'm looking at are not coastal settings. The U.S. has regional orientations, and I think it's important to note that the country is large, and a lot of higher education arguments focus on coasts, and the western and east coast of the U.S. have particular orientations, if you will, to the Pacific Rim or to other financial hubs, particularly from the east coast institutions through alumni networks. There are many institutions, higher ed institutions in the states that do not have those kind of networks and yet have been recipients of federal funds and have faced these kinds of cuts and therefore made arguments about the value of Chinese money for foreign language, for Chinese language study.
Right. And I think, you know, that's another good point of the book that I think I mentioned, sort of highlighting different analysis that we haven't seen. really talking about funding, the funding that comes from institutions are actually, you know, they're being sought out because domestic policy, which sometimes we don't get into when we're thinking of international education policy. So that's really a great connection, I think.
Well, that's interesting that you put it that way, because yes, there is an intersection everywhere of domestic and international policy. And sometimes international studies, particularly in the States, is all about everything except the U.S. Right. And so we need to look at that nexus again of U.S. and international, the changing international landscape. China has been it's interesting how much China has featured in the U.S. imaginary. I don't know, larger than life. I don't know if anything is possible larger than life, but there's definitely an enthusiasm that we've seen in U.S. higher education for working with China that's come up in the last five years, certainly, and Confucius Institutes play into that.
Absolutely. So if we can keep moving along,
sure.
You have three universities, which you have talked about. If you can let us know, you know, sort of how you chose those universities, or at least like maybe sort of how you made the connection with those universities. And then if you want to get into it, we can kind of start talking about sort of what are these Confucius Institutes doing on the campuses, and specifically, what there a lot of language teaching is a part of the Confucius Institutes. How are they teaching Mandarin language? I know you talk about sort of ideology within that, within the language teaching. So if you can kind of talk about the language aspect from these schools.
Sure. I'll answer your first question just briefly first. How did I select these institutions? They all represent that public higher education research and teaching-oriented university. Mm-hmm. That are the majority and not the exceptions that much of the research has focused on. I inquired with the administrators as to whether I might approach the institutions I did enroll in Chinese language classes. And you refer to the word embedded. I like to think of it as anthropology and ethnography. And embedded is very open kind of embedment because the research was done in a way in which the students and the teachers and the administrators, including the U.S. and the China directors, were quite aware of. And so it was a very, embedded, it certainly was participatory and observational. Okay. So in anthropological sense, it was the participant observation that I felt was an important methodology to bring to the project. And that meant that I could complement interviews and other research about Confucius Institutes with some of my own experience as to what was going on as a student, and then also as a researcher who would observe and also interview the students and teachers afterwards. So the methodology involved participation, observation, interview, analysis of primary documents associated with the three universities. I would say that the three universities, I did not engage with them in terms of time in an equal manner. Mm-hmm. Just life, as it will, didn't permit it. In the wonderful days of graduate student life when we do field research for extended periods of time, that's really a treasure. But at this particular stage of my career, I wasn't able to actually take termly or semester-long classes in each one of the institutions equally. Nevertheless, the kinds of curricula and the textbooks that were being used were comparable in different places, and site visits and interviews and observations helped to sort of put these three institutions into complementary perspective. You asked me about how language is taught in Confucius Institutes. Well, I found that in some classrooms, Chinese teachers of Chinese who were from China, were not able to reach out as much as they would have liked to a wide student pool. Mm-hmm. So the students who came to class were often self-selected and had particular interests that the secondary literature on Confucius Institutes alone would not have predicted for me. So it was really sort of the idiosyncratic interests of individuals coming to learn the language, and they learned, students learned the language with special interests, so the vocabulary that's taught was often particular to the interests of students. In chapter 3 of the book, I focus on what's taught in a Confucius Institute classroom, and I use the framework that a colleague of mine, Stanton Wortham at UPenn, and others, drawing on many others, divides into language use, language form, language ideology, and language domain. I look at language use, which is literally what's being taught phonetically and grammatically in the textbooks, and I look at how that teaching plays out in the classroom. Language form has to do with sort of how teachers teach the context for correct usage, so it's not just the grammar, what you say, but you know how you say it and inflect it in a particular context. Language ideology has to do with more implicit of what teachers are teaching, not how they're explicitly teaching about the cultural context, but I find, I mean, ideology sounds like it's a big sort of conspiracy thing of state ideology, but really what I'm talking about are the beliefs that people bring to the use of language that they're not aware of until they begin to speak the language. And there are numerous examples in the book. You may be able to pull one or two out more easily than I can, because there are so many that I work with. So the context that people realize and discover through the classroom of what the language means that they would not have thought of otherwise. One of the issues that came up for students, U.S. students, American students, for some of the classrooms was, were languages of words for holidays. International Women's Day was something that was very much part of the Chinese discourse of education, and yet from a U.S. perspective, the idea of a U.N.-recognized holiday that recognizes international women was not something that American students were generally familiar with. Other more stereotypic for U.S. for Americans, and other more stereotypic examples might be the Maoist star, excuse me. Some calligraphy classes. I studied not only language classes, but also calligraphy and paper cutting classes as well. Calligraphy classes or paper cutting classes will often evoke signs and symbols that teachers and students would read in different ways. I'll just bring an anecdote in. One way in which language evoked a sense of meaning that students didn't quite realize they shared with the teachers was the Maoist star. I'm having trouble saying that. And the teacher herself was quite reminiscent about how, as a child in school in China, you know, this was something that they cut and sort of was part of the everyday life. For students in the U.S. universities, it was initially appalling or shocking. One could read in the way they reacted to it that this was a sort of a Maoist communist star in the classroom, and they used that object, if you will, to come to a discussion about a bit about history.
Okay, and that's a great segue, because I was just about to ask you, one of my favorite parts of the book is when you are describing the history class, the 5,000 years of history. And I think it was like a 90-minute period. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because it's such a fantastic sort of just encompassing tale of sort of maybe the idea of Confucius Institute.
I enjoyed that. That's chapter 2, where I deal with history in lots of different ways in one chapter. But the end of that chapter presents history as it was taught in a Confucius class at one of these universities, one, as you say, 90-minute session approximately, I suppose, where the teacher covered thousands of years of history for an audience crammed into the classroom who had never had a class on Chinese history. Now, on the one hand, they're learning a lot, or they're being exposed to a lot in a university that wasn't at the time, I don't know if it is now, wasn't at the time teaching history, Chinese history for credit. On the other hand, they're learning a lot slide by slide very quickly of information that they are being taught rather didactically. They're not engaged in an inquiry-oriented mode the way students in most history classes in the U.S. would be engaged over a semester, at least, long time to understand that kind of history. So the students who were in that history class were there for a particular reason. They were offered extra credit to sit in on that class. And so it was an evening class. They were quite quiet. No one had questions at the end. There were a few questions from older adult students who were not themselves university students, just asking about tourist sites and so on. The university students themselves, who were there for extra credit, I have to put a personal commentary in here. I was quite sad that they didn't ask more questions. I think that might point to a missed opportunity on their part, and maybe even on the part of their university professors, who might encourage more direct questioning and even preparation going into those kinds of lecture classes where students could learn something from a Chinese professor, a professor from China. Right. After all, it is professors from China who staff the Confucius Institutes. So I was interested to see that at the end of the session, the university students asked the scholar from China to simply sign their extra credit form rather than engage and ask questions. Nonetheless, the exposure that they had in that one session, it's hard to argue against it. It's, one might say, better than nothing. Others might say, no, it's not better than nothing. But I tend to myself think it's better than nothing, but it certainly is a missed opportunity to engage with a scholar from China.
Okay, very nice. And like I said, it's a very sort of, you know, informative, yet I think kind of funny, like, tale.
Oh.
I definitely enjoyed it. Maybe as someone who's studied some history in the past, and I can sort of understand sort of, you know, where do you begin with 5,000 years of history? So
maybe also where students begin who are listening to lectures of that kind as well, at least as we, you know, sort of begun to think of history as something that we really need to, you know, understand through inquiry. But let me just say one more thing. I see you want to move on to another topic. But one more thing on that is the lesson that's conveyed in that section of Chapter 2 is not untypical, which is to say it's typical of the kind of the history classes that are taught in other Confucius Institutes. Not everywhere. I mean, I need to qualify that, you know, I understand that there's a range of what's taught in Confucius Institutes, but the lesson itself was a template, if you will, that's taught elsewhere as well.
Okay, fantastic. If you can kind of talk about, you know, who these people who are running the Confucius Institutes, working there, the administrators, what are their sort of expectations for the program, for the organization, and how does that kind of fit into the overall goals of the Confucius Institutes in general?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. There are different administrators, if you will, in the Confucius Institutes. There are U.S. side or host university administrators, and then administrators who are coming from the partner university in China. Those Chinese administrators, or administrators in China, are professors, typically, of their subject. They may not be teaching, they may not be professors of Chinese language, they may be a professor of archaeology or a professor of history or something, but it is a combination of administrators of U.S. side and China-based scholars. In the classroom itself, the teachers are the visiting scholars from China. They are academics. They have been hired into an administrative post to come to the U.S. They're in the U.S. mainly, and there are exceptions to this, so let me just qualify that I'm really speaking generally, mainly on a visiting scholar visa. So on the campuses where they are working, they are recognized not as university employees in that university, but rather they are visiting scholars from partner universities in China who are offering classes, non-credit generally, for anyone who wants to come to the Confucius Institute. Administrators everywhere, administrators are accountable to many stakeholders. So the Chinese scholars who are working in Confucius Institutes are accountable to their home universities and to the employing agencies, if you will, within the Ministry of Education and the government of China. they therefore have to be accountable in terms of numbers of students, quality of teaching. They themselves face, and I want to say this, you know, because anthropology tends to be try to understand subjects from subjects' positions, but those administrators from scholars face difficulty gaining traction in U.S. higher education institutions because of the different administrative systems that U.S. higher education institutions and Chinese institutions operate by. Those China scholars tend to be generally frustrated with U.S. higher education system because it's not centralized enough, if you will. The concern is that they're not able really to do the job that they have been sent to do. On the other side of the coin, U.S. universities operate typically by shared governance, whereby employees who are pre-tenured and tenured on the basis of their scholarship and publication, it is employees working with administrators and other stakeholders, including students, to determine what the curriculum is. So the China scholars who are coming on a J-1 visa or visiting scholars are seen as nice visitors in some ways, but aren't typically part of the governing structure, and for reasonable reasons, because that governing structure in U.S. higher education is designed for a collaborative, multi-voiced, if you will, a decision-making process that is not centralized and is not top-down. And I think that's certainly one of the assets of the U.S. system as well. But sometimes it's that difference and lack of understanding that the China scholars can't do their job because the system doesn't allow them to. That serves as a sign of frustration for those scholars.
I see. Okay. And as you mentioned, you know, they're here on sort of the visa. They're not really employees, and they kind of, and you mentioned in the book a little bit, sort of gotten in trouble in the past about going out to schools and teaching Mandarin language courses in schools as well. And I think you mentioned that in the book that one of the universities just simply stopped all of that and tried to sort of bring in students to the school instead, or was there any sort of workaround that they could figure out from there? Or?
Yeah, so affecting many Confucius Institutes in the U.S., I believe it was 2012, yes, it was 2012, mm-hmm. Teachers on visiting scholar visas to the U.S. from China were called in for understandable reasons, because they had been working in K-12 settings, mm-hmm. and in higher education settings. And when anyone in the U.S. is working in a K-12 setting, one needs to have certain kinds of checks and you know, particular considerations. The scholars from China who were working in K-12 settings were quite keen to teach Chinese language, calligraphy, arts and crafts in public school settings, K-12. And indeed, these public school teachers and administrators were not averse, perhaps welcoming in some cases, to having teachers come in and teach for free Chinese language. You know, you have to remember, this is a time right now when parents are eager, for whatever reason, to have their children learn Chinese. It's the next best thing, because it's, you know, the economy is seen as what their children, where their children are going to get jobs. We can debate that, and others are more, you know, able to debate that better than I am. But nonetheless, there's such an eagerness on the part of parents for their children to learn Chinese that Confucius Institute scholars from China were going into K-12 settings without the proper visa regulations. One way around that at the time, this is just two years ago, was then to bring students from these public schools to campus. Mm. Whether this is a reasonable way of working the bureaucracy or whether it cuts against the spirit of what was happening, you have to realize this is an administrative way of thinking about things. So no matter, you know, every administrators everywhere do this. So it was another sort of way of collaborating and teaching younger children Chinese. Now, we can debate whether they really are learning Chinese, what's happening in the classrooms. Even we can debate whether there's a sort of Sinophilia happening through these. That's not the point of this book. I'm really more interested, what's the logic by which
right.
these educational settings in the U.S. are interested in working with.
Right. And I think that, you know, that is sort of an example of sort of the duality that these organizations are having to work together in, certainly. But, you know, if we can sort of talk about who are the people actually taking the classes, sitting in the classes, who are they, and sort of how do they see themselves? I know you kind of were perhaps a little bit critical on this idea that there was some sort of global citizenship going on with these students, or at least in some aspect. If you want to maybe talk about that.
I myself have my eyes opened a bit, because from the secondary literature and certainly from the university admin language, I would have expected more students interested in the universities now, these aren't K-12, but in universities, getting their hands on learning Chinese. I was surprised to see in some settings, many settings, I would say, the majority of students were not people who I wouldn't have expected enrolling, including stakeholders in the community involved in the university, administrators themselves enrolling in some case. There was obviously me, an anthropologist, so that's sort of an unusual kind of a student. Right? So I'll acknowledge that. But it was an interesting conglomeration in some cases of students. There were the group of extra credit university students was one case, but sometimes I saw university students who were themselves from China, but were privately funded students coming to U.S. higher education for degrees within the U.S. Sometimes themselves, I wouldn't say recruited by, but colleagues and friends of other students from China, including in some cases teachers who were teaching in these universities in the Confucius Institutes. So first language Chinese students were on some occasions in the university, in the Confucius Institutes themselves. So already knowing China, coming to Confucius Institutes to watch a movie in Chinese.
Right.
So, you know, there was a bit of a sort of social life, or to cook Chinese,
right,
in a Chinese cooking class. That was certainly an arena where non-U.S. citizens coming from, you know, Chinese who are in the U.S., who are coming to the U.S. to study, would find a social connection in Confucius Institutes in the area of cooking and cutting and teaching. So some of the very teachers in Confucius Institutes were themselves surrogate teachers.
Right.
they weren't the Confucius Institute teachers, but there was quite a bit of collaboration and crosstalk and exchange between different kinds of Chinese students, whether visiting scholars or students on private funds in the U.S. Did you have something particular in mind that...
I was thinking of, you specifically, you have some interesting characters. There's one woman who, I think she was looking to adopt a Chinese, I guess, baby from China. So that was sort of her connection into the community, the only way she really knew how. And then I think maybe there was a Taiwanese second generation student as well. So, you know, some of these students who, you know, it seems like they're there for their own reason, I think, but they're all very different reasons.
I think that's exactly the point, is people have a great deal of personal motivation, independent motivation for studying Chinese. It's the image of mass campaign and brainwashing, which maybe I'm overstating what the other secondary literature says, but people seem to be quite independent and pragmatic in their reasons for studying Chinese in these Confucius Institutes. And often it's in places where, or contexts where, they don't have classrooms that are available at the time in the main university, or it's, costs money, or the university itself isn't even offering those classes. I would say that the depth of the Confucius Institute classes, as I've seen them taught in Chinese and Confucius Institutes, seems to be different, more narrow, than the curricular offerings in university for credit programs.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a different experience that a student will have in a Confucius Institute learning Chinese history, obviously, and Chinese language, than if they were to be enrolled in in the university setting. But as you suggest, the social context of the Confucius Institute was quite an eye-opener for me in terms of people's reasons socially for coming to the Confucius Institute.
Right. And I also want to mention you mentioned that they were sort of pulling in students from the campus. Maybe they were already Chinese students. And I think one quoted in saying, when she told you, she said, "Yeah, of course I have to come because we never have enough people who come to these. And they, you know, ask me to come." So were you seeing sort of a dearth of students and participants in these programs? And that's what kind of what it seemed like.
A point there is that the Chinese scholar administrators are themselves accountable to their employers, which are not U.S. employers. Mm-hmm. They're accountable for the numbers that are brought into Confucius Institute classes. So I did not see campaigns to recruit students in the sense of, you know, come to the class because you'll get free food. But there is a concern about not having sufficient numbers, particularly because the contractual relations between the host university and the university in China often stipulate numbers for enrollees. And there are quid pro quo aspects to the contract. Every university negotiates a different contract. It is not an openly negotiated contract. That's key. So the contract that's being negotiated between U.S. host and Chinese university is not subject to the typically. It's not typically subject to the governance procedure of other aspects of contracts that universities might negotiate. There are legal reasons for that, and I'm not a legal scholar, so I won't comment on that. But let me just say that the conditions of the contract are often particular to a university and may include numbers of enrollees, not only in U.S. Confucius Institutes, but in U.S. programs that are being hosted in China. So, increasingly, you may be aware, and the listeners may be aware too, universities, particularly these publicly funded universities, are looking for new sources of revenue. Mm-hmm. Those new sources of revenue have to do with new student tuition monies. China, we all know, many people know this in this area, China is a large draw for new recruits to the U.S. universities that provide extra tuition. In addition, universities are teaching particularly English language classes in China, and those are revenue-generating programs, mm-hmm. or I should say universities hope for them to be revenue-generating. U.S. universities hope that they will generate revenue. So sometimes a contract will be negotiated such that the numbers of students coming to a U.S. program in China, mm-hmm. hosted by the U.S. hosting institution, those numbers need to be a certain amount, and China scholars need to help recruit those students to U.S. programs that then would generate revenue. If you're not meeting those quotas, whether the Confucius Institute side in the U.S. or the U.S. Programs that are in China, the contract gets a little bit messy, and so there is pressure to bring people into classes in different places, including Confucius Institutes.
Right. And I do know that the Chinese government is funding these Confucius Institutes, but their idea was that they would eventually be sort of self-sustaining after a while from tuition.
Yes. I never understood the argument for self-sustaining because there are structural reasons why U.S. universities do not actually see them as integral, mm-hmm. A stopgap measure on U.S. campuses.
Right.
Self-funding, I didn't hear arguments about that. I know that those arguments are out there, but I didn't see that playing out. It was more simply revenue generating for U.S. universities.
And I think that brings us kind of perfectly to sort of the final chapter where you pose the question, saving face or selling out, as this Confucius Institute relationship goes for American universities. So if you could, maybe just explain what the idea of saving face is, because it kind of comes up in these classes that people are learning about, and you know, business-wise, when you're sort of learning Chinese language, those kind of things. And then how you sort of are phrasing that question is for Confucius Institutes and American universities.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to end with that one. So saving face is a metaphor that I found coming through Confucius Institute programs, particularly around business etiquette classes. Confucius Institutes teach classes on how to conduct business appropriately, the culturally appropriate way of conducting business in China. And one of the typical scenarios for hosting that kind of a Confucius Institute class is in a Chinese restaurant. Any, you know, whether it's authentic or American, it doesn't matter, but in a Chinese restaurant where there is a PowerPoint discussion about how to conduct business. And it was quite interesting to see the overt teaching of proper business conduct in China. As I say, I'm not a China scholar, although having colleagues there and traveled there, not extensively, the way in which business etiquette was taught did resonate with my limited experience in China, which is that there's a very sort of proper way in which one engages and does not call another colleague out in a business relation in a public way, but rather helps want to save face. And so the idea of saving face in the Chinese phrase is reiterated and a featured part of a business etiquette class. My argument in the last chapter is I raise the question for the readers, to what extent is collaborating with across continents with Confucius Institutes a matter of saving face or selling out? The argument that U.S. administrators have that is offered publicly is generally that these institutes will provide revenue. The revenue doesn't follow in various ways. So I ask the question throughout the book, what other reasons might be going on? What else is happening here? And I argue that this diplomatic mission is key and it's important. It's essential, in fact. I think it's a essential part of education and that we shouldn't lose sight of that. These are colleagues and we are colleagues and we need to work at the level of collegiality. At the same time, the argument that that Confucius Institutes will teach Chinese and help to save underfunded humanities programs seems to be a secondary rationalization for something else that's going on. And here I'm thinking really on the U.S. side, and I'm not a China scholar, I'm not talking about what's going on there because that's not my area, but in the U.S. side, there's a use of Confucius Institutes, including the banquet setting, to bring people around the table to negotiate new things. Mm-hmm. And some of the new things that are being negotiated, as I saw it in this work around the table of business etiquette, the new things that are being negotiated with new scholars and collaborations with China are opportunities for U.S. universities to convert intellectual property to patentable and licensable and marketable products, the investment from which, as university-owned property, can then be reinvested in U.S. universities. So my question is in not recognizing that, in not asking that question, not saying openly, that's what we're doing here. This is about bringing new partners together in a market economy, funding new intellectual property, and creating relationships diplomatically and through markets. That seems to me to be what we need to talk about with regard to Confucius Institutes. And if we don't talk about what those various opportunities are and what is being done in multiple ways besides teaching Chinese, then we are, in a sense, saving face and not really working in the mode of U.S. higher education, which is to think openly and analytically about what it is that's going on here. And I think if we begin to do that kind of questioning, we might see that Confucius Institutes, ironically, are not all bad and, you know, neither all good. So I'm just trying to get away from that polarized idea of the Trojan horse coming right into U.S. universities. As we began the conversation here, I think there are reasons that universities take up these institutions and other things, and it has to do, I argue, by the end, with new economic opportunities that are not part of revenue generation through collaborative projects in the area of education, but are about as people will say in university circles, it's about creating new marketable property with colleagues in China with whom we are not, it's not about language study, but it's about intellectual collaborations in science and technology in areas that that are translatable mm-hmm. from intellectual ideas into commodities and into property that can be owned by universities themselves. And certainly universities in China are also quite interested in intellectual property revenue generation in that way. And I think that's a key part of the problem or the issue that that I hope we recognize here.
Absolutely. And I think, as I mentioned sort of at the beginning, that way of viewing Confucius Institutes and the partnership is quite refreshing, which we haven't really been able to see by a lot of the other analysis on this these new ventures. We haven't really seen this analysis.
Well, I appreciate that because I know that you have written yourself on Confucius Institutes, and I thank you very much for sharing your thesis with me on that. China's soft power in education, measuring Confucius Institutes. Yardstick. I learned a tremendous amount, so thank you very much.
Absolutely. No, it was my pleasure. If I could, what's next? What's next for you? Where are you researching next and on your intellectual path?
Maybe it's a bit back to the future, because I find that I really enjoy the horizons of working with colleagues and friends and collaborators in parts of East Africa. Mm. So I've been working recently, initially framing the project as I'm studying Confucius Institutes in East Africa. I'm moving away from studying Confucius Institutes per se to really understanding how the world of education is changing. Mm. It's less about North-South development, perhaps not even about East-West development, but about new opportunities that people everywhere face and hope for. And so I'm working right now in universities in East Africa, looking at the aspirations and opportunities that higher education university students, African students have, and how they see their future in connection with China.
Fantastic. Well, we definitely would look forward to that. So thank you, Amy Stombach, for being here today. And I just want to urge everyone, especially if you're interested in China, higher education, Confucius Institutes, please go check out Confucius and Crisis in American Universities, Culture, Capital, and Diplomacy in U.S. Public Higher Education. Thank you very much. Hope you learned something.
It's a pleasure.